content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next hour, I will be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com. That is gsuggsinsurance.com. Or call 919-875-8889. Today's edition of Time Magazine will be from my archives. We have no new magazine today. So the first articles you'll hear will be from the November 21st/November 28th edition of Time that has a graphic illustration on the front of red, white, and blue, red bars, white stars, a blue rectangle over the top of which is a black squiggle. Now this is over an off-white to ivory page with Time emblazoned in large white capital letters on the top of the page, surrounded by a narrow white inner border and the usual bright red outer border. Beginning then with the view. World, Next Year's Energy Crisis by Surya Jayanti. For policymakers grappling with global energy shortages and households scrambling to pay record-high utility bills, some unwelcome news. This year's energy crisis is going to look mild compared with that of winter 2023-2024. That is going to be the real crisis. Any energy planning must account for next year and beyond, where this winter is a problem. 2023's may be a catastrophe. Jayanti, who wrote this article, is an Eastern European energy policy expert who served 10 years as a U.S. diplomat, including as the energy chief at the U.S. Embassy in Kyiv, Ukraine, from 2018 to 2020. The immediate problem is simple. There is not enough fuel and therefore not enough electricity, so prices have skyrocketed for both. To a large extent, this is a result of decreased Russian exports of oil, natural gas, and coal, which have been hit by Western sanctions and other policy efforts to curb Russian revenues funding the war on Ukraine. Most Russian fuel supplies are still reaching international markets, however, because countries like China and India are happy to buy discounted product from a not quite marginalized Kremlin. But Russian exports are down too, approximately 18% in August compared with February. Notwithstanding a current drop in natural gas prices, Russian President Vladimir Putin is enjoying record energy revenues, over 200 billion euro since the start of the war, February 24. In turn, markets are tight globally and countries are competing for limited supplies in what has become a zero-sum energy game. This year's energy shortage is not just a Russia problem, however. Other factors keeping energy supply below demand are the unexpected surge in economic and industrial activity as countries awoke from COVID-19, refining capacity shortfalls caused by myriad fires, labor strikes, and maintenance activities, and overall inflation that puts upward pressure on prices independent of supply constraints. The knock-on effects on electricity, high prices, and lower-than-normal generation exist because most power plants burn oil, coal, or natural gas. Utilities can neither raise prices on consumers without regulatory approval nor buy fuel imports with unchecked debt under existing laws that prevent risky behavior by critical service providers. Many power plants around the world are struggling to continue generating electricity. Meanwhile, there are not nearly enough nuclear, wind, solar, and other non-fossil fuel alternatives, and hydroelectric plants worldwide are suffering because of climate change droughts. The end result is current or forecast brown and blackouts across the developing world in parts of Europe, maybe in the U.S. too, according to the U.S. Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. Developing countries are the worst off because they have less ability to absorb higher energy costs. This is the situation we're in now, which winter will exacerbate, but it's going to be a walk in the park compared with next year to start with. This year is not as bad as it could be. Although this year's winter will prove uncomfortable and expensive, Europe is nonetheless in a surprisingly good position. Block-wide, natural gas storages are now well over 90% of the annual target, which is actually at least 15% higher than their levels a year ago. This is not enough to heat and power the continent through a cold winter or even a normal winter at current consumption levels. But barring any unforeseen calamities, current natural gas reserves are probably enough for one winter if the EU succeeds in implementing both its voluntary and mandatory 15% electricity usage reduction policies. Of course, a warm winter and a 15% consumption reduction is a best-case scenario, and it's far from certain it will play out. During a cold snap in September and October, poles were burning trash to stay warm. Europeans are hoarding firewood. Blackouts are already occurring in some countries. And unfortunately, warm weather, now coupled with energy subsidies, is likely to disincentivize conservation of existing energy resources. What is certain is that if Europeans and the rest of us could see ahead to 2023 and beyond, we would be doing everything in our power to save energy reserves now in preparation. Europe's likely to be short by 20 to 30 billion cubic meters of its needed fuel in 2023. The bulk of what it can secure will come at a price so high that recession-hit governments will have trouble buying fuel while simultaneously paying their populations' energy bills. Without the ability to bring new energy sources online in a hurry, the only tool governments have at their immediate disposal is cutting consumption. This is the equivalent of zipping up the tent in a hurricane, but it is what is available at this point. Here is the page of 8 questions. The column is written by Andrew R. Chow. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Well, no, there are more than that. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Okay, this is F. Murray Abraham. Today, the Oscar-winning actor talks about the new season of The White Lotus on HBO, acting in his 9th decade and growing up on the Mexican border. There's a portrait in black and white. It's small in the middle of the column, but it does indeed look like this is a gentrified individual, at least by age. He's partially bald. He has a short, dark gray, I'm going to say, hair that's remaining, dark eyebrows, and gray facial hair. He has dark eyes, and he's just smiling a little bit imperturbably at the camera. The top of his body that we see, this is primarily a headshot, is in clothed in something very dark, black perhaps, with a high collar. It is not a suit. It is not a sport coat. It is something else, some other attire. Question, your character on The White Lotus, Bert, is a flatulent, crass womanizer. How did you relate to him? Answer, they are in my family. I'm 83 and come from an era where that was very common. They're funny people. They're so insensitive, but at the same time, loving and kind and generous. But they do have a blind spot when it comes to women. No question about that. I was raised that way. What a great relief to become a feminist. As a man, I do not have to carry the world on my shoulders. Question, you called acting an awful, awful profession in a 1986 interview. Would you agree now? Answer, when it's bad, it's awful. 85% of actors in the union are out of work, always. One study says 90%. There were times when I was out of work for 6-7 months. You begin to doubt, to forget who you are. You can make a living as a waiter. You try anyway, but that's not who we are. But when it works, it is great. I don't think I'm ever more alive than when I'm on stage, and that's a hell of a thing to say because I have a wonderful life, really. Question. You have delivered King Lear soliloquies and crude masturbation jokes alike. Do you approach them with the same part of your brain? Answer. It certainly is the same craft and the same exuberance. Frankly, if I had a choice, it would always be comedy. The thing about Salieri, whom he played in the 1984 film Amadeus, which people do not mention, they make him out to be a villain. In fact, the older Salieri is pretty funny. You go to the same well, whether it is comedy or farce, you're looking for the truth. So you do farce completely serious. You mean these stupid things you say. With Bert, it is just the truth that masturbation is important every day. Ask any doctor. Question. You've played heroes, villains, and comic relief. When you pick up a script now, what qualities do you look for? Answer. You want a great script and a great character. I would love to be a hero, a lover, an 83-year-old man who discovers love. Older people don't get a fair shake about that. You're still capable of loving. Question. Do you feel more or less motivated in your acting than in decades past? Answer. More. I feel like I'm running out of time. There's a lot to do. If I live to 100, that's only 17 years. It ain't enough time. So I look forward to my work now as I always have. That is what is so astonishing about my good luck. There's a lot of talent out there, and they just can't get arrested, as we say in the business. Question. You grew up in El Paso, Texas, 2 blocks from the Rio Grande. What kind of perspective did that upbringing give you about the current immigration debates? Answer. This is a tragedy. I used to practically live in Juarez, Mexico. I went to school and had dinner with the people that lived there. It was not dangerous. Some of them did not speak English very well, and I learned some Spanish from them. Now this is a different world. I think it is a real tragedy that the border is not a place of free exchange between cultures. Question. You are also part Syrian. Have the Arabic roles you've played changed over the course of your career? Answer. I think originally, because of my name, I got a lot of Jewish parts. Some of the best performances of my life were my portrayals of Jews, like Roy Cohn in Angels in America, a character I have no regard for. After it became known I was Syrian, they started offering me Arabic roles. The Jewish parts are much richer. They don't draw Arabs very well. Usually, they're bad guys. Question. You are a longtime theater teacher. What advice do you give your students? Answer. I still teach once or twice a year for free. I just do it because I like it. Every class, I start and end by saying, "Don't be afraid." That's it. From the brief news, good question, why do lottery jackpots keep getting bigger? By Anisha Coley. One lucky ticket sold at Joe's Service Center in Altadena, California, brought some very good news November 8. It held the only set of winning numbers in what was the largest Powerball drawing in U.S. history, with a jackpot worth $2.04 billion dollars. The incredible sum, more than 28,000 years worth of earnings for the median American household, was a far cry from the first Powerball drawing, a now measly sounding $5.9 million win in 1992. In the years since, the U.S. economy has been altered by recessions, inflation, demographic changes, and tech. At the same time, the major lotteries have changed their rules to ensure jackpots grow. In 2012, for example, Powerball tickets went up from $1 to $2 per ticket. The game format has since undergone several changes to expand the number pool, lengthening the odds that any individual drawing results in a jackpot winner. The effect is that jackpots have swelled. In the industry, they have what they call jackpot fatigue, where what they found with research and practical experiences is that smaller jackpots no longer appeal to players. Keith White, executive director for the National Council on Problem Gaming, tells Time. They are designing the games deliberately to maximize bigger jackpots that are rare. One way to do that is to make the odds worse so the jackpot gets bigger. Playing the lottery or the numbers before states took over in the 70s and 80s paved the way to legalized gambling, of which a slight majority of Americans disapproved a few decades ago. Polls today show most Americans now approve. There has been a massive cultural shift, if you will, White says. And I do think that's also reflected in these larger jackpots. But as jackpots grow, so do criticisms. Les Bernal of the nonprofit advocacy group Stop Predatory Gambling believes state-sanctioned lotteries are particularly exploitative because of how they affect marginalized groups. It's a form of financial fraud that is only legal if you partner with the state government, he says. Research suggests that state lottery retailers tend to be concentrated in lower-income areas and communities of color. A Consumer Federation of America survey found that a fifth of Americans believe the lottery is the only feasible way for them to acquire several hundred thousand dollars. And as White points out, large prizes tend to attract even those who would not gamble in other settings. Drew Savitko, Powerball Product Group Chair and the Pennsylvania Lottery's Executive Director, tells Time, since the mid-1960s, lotteries in the U.S. have provided entertainment for millions of players while returning billions of dollars in funding for vital public programs, services, and good causes such as education, health and welfare, transportation, and the environment to benefit the quality of life for residents in their states with stringent government compliance requirements. A little more than a third of Powerball ticket sale funds go to public services, though critics allege some states use that money as an excuse to lower budgets. Half goes to jackpots, and the rest to cover costs. What the critics say is not a fair assertion, and unfortunately, these are common misconceptions about the lottery industry that are not based on fact, Svitko says. People all from all walks of life and income levels play lottery games. What remains is the selling point, the potential, if exceedingly extreme, unlikelihood of winning big enough to fuel anyone's daydreams. From the Bulletin, this is by Ciara Nugent. Lula, L-U-L-A, Lula's win in Brazil gives the Amazon a fighting chance. The result of Brazil's October 30 election was the best news the global climate fight has had in a while. Jair Bolsonaro, the far-right incumbent who has overseen an unrelenting surge in deforestation in the Amazon rainforest, narrowly lost out on a second term. Bolsonaro took 49.1% of the vote against 50.9% for Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, a leftist former president who has pledged to protect the crucial carbon sink and has a track record to back up his promises. The fertile lands of the Amazon have always been a target for Brazil's farmers, loggers, and miners. In a bid to appeal to those groups, Bolsonaro gutted the budgets of agencies tasked with preventing deforestation. More than 12,800 square miles of the Brazilian Amazon were lost from 2019 to 2021, a 60% jump from the 3 years before. That is a sharp contrast to what happened under Lula's 2003 to 2010 government, which increased policing and created more sustainable jobs in the Amazon region. From 2004 to 2012, the annual deforestation rate fell by 80%. Lula says he will now fight for zero deforestation. It won't be easy. Since he was last in charge, organized crime groups have expanded in the Amazon, offering protection for those plundering natural resources and doing violence to those who challenge them. Bolsonaro's allies in Congress may rush to weaken environmental laws before January 1, when Lula takes office and gets veto power. But Lula will be aided by an international community desperate to stop the release of the Amazon's stored carbon, which could trigger irreversible climate harm. Norway and Germany have offered billions to fund programs suspended under Bolsonaro, while EU food importers are pressuring Brazilian agribusiness to end deforestation. That is no longer a priority just for Brazil, says Marcio Ostrini, a Brazilian campaigner, but for the world. From the Time Off section, Everybody Loves a Cowboy, by Noel Murray. Yellowstone's runaway success may be driven by the heartland, but its appeal transcends politics. There's a cover illustration on the beginning of this section. It's kind of a montage of four almost mirror image photographs. They're not photographs, they're illustrations of a cowboy. The face is the same in all of them. And the coloration is red, white, and blue in all of them, but it kind of reverses within which section of the grid you're looking. In the first section, the cowboy is wearing a red jacket and a blue shirt and a blue hat, and his face is red. And then the next one, the jacket's blue, the shirt's red, the hat's red, and the face is blue. And there are two other variations of similar ilk. Going to the text, though, in March 2018, 3 months before the hit Paramount Network drama Yellowstone debuted, an Alberta, Canada woman who goes by the internet handle Tori F. began creating social media accounts under the heading Yellowstone TV Fans. Tori F. had been building fan spaces online since the mid-2000s, and as an admirer of the actor Kelly Riley, who plays Yellowstone's ruthless, damaged businesswoman Beth Dutton, she saw a lot of potential in this show. It looked to be both a Western and a family melodrama, two genres underrepresented on TV. More important, it looked pulpy and fun. She says, I was on the lookout for something new, for a Sunday night watch party with friends. Right away, though, Tori F. noticed something different about the Yellowstone fans she was interacting with online. They were 10 to 20 years older than most people who gab about TV on the internet, and they were mostly scattered across the U.S. heartland, not in big coastal cities. Since 2018, Yellowstone has become one of the most watched scripted dramas on cable, often outdrawing shows on major networks. January's fourth season finale had over 9 million viewers the night it aired, excluding those who streamed it later, nearly double the number who watched the season 3 finale. By comparison, the Emmy-winning, critically acclaimed HBO drama Succession, which tells a similar story about a wealthy family fighting to hold on to its place in the modern world, drew 1.7 million on all platforms, including some 600,000 watching on cable, for its third season finale a few weeks earlier. But who's watching Yellowstone? That's a question that tends to perplex people who write about TV for a living. When the show's fifth season debuted November 18, it will likely dominate ratings again, while drawing little attention from major media outlets or the people who hand out awards. It was nominated for one Emmy. Rotten Tomatoes links to 10 critic reviews for its fourth season versus 141 for Succession's third. While Yellowstone does get written about, it's often described as a red state show, loved more by Texas gun-toters than Brooklyn hipsters. That is not entirely wrong. Networks hold on tightly to detailed demographic data, but at the end of season two, Paramount's website touted huge viewership in cities like Dallas, Oklahoma City, and Fort Myers, Florida. Woke Hollywood may read that as a fandom of book-banning suburban moms and angry dudes in MAGA hats, but it is not that simple. At a time when audiences are fragmented and frequently seem only to want to watch people who think and look like themselves on TV, it is apt that a show that shares its name with a river has found success by being a mainstream. While it's true that a lot of big hit shows have only a minimal presence in the larger popular culture, no one's handing out Emmys or writing weekly think pieces about NCIS Hawaii, after all. It sure feels as if Yellowstone should be discussed more. Its star, Kevin Costner, is an Oscar winner. Co-creator and showrunner Taylor Sheridan wrote the critically acclaimed movies Sicario and Hell or High Water. His stories tackle corporate greed, class conflict, racial identity, all topics that usually get cultural commentators excited. Republicans who support candidates vowing to protect faith, family, and the Second Amendment could certainly be drawn to Costner's John Dutton, a rugged Montana ranching magnate who pines for the good old days and uses brute force against his political enemies. But the show does not seem to be trying to actively court that crowd. Yellowstone's premise is in line with those of classic nighttime soaps, like Dallas, in which nearly every character has a little bit of angel and a little bit of devil in them, and where the stories sometimes dispense with logic to get to the next cliffhanger. The issues Yellowstone raises about land stewardship and big business are relevant, but the plots are more about romance, violence, and feuds, all played out against a gorgeous Montana backdrop. The 170,000-plus followers on Tori F.'s Facebook page are mostly focused on those soapy elements. They speculate about big plot twists and generate memes. One popular recurring bit of fan shtick is someone posting, "I watch Yellowstone for the plot," followed by images of hunky cowboys. Fans also pine for life on the Dutton sprawling picturesque spread, where anybody who's willing to work can become part of the family. Katie Bowlby is a digital director of Country Living magazine, which has covered Yellowstone extensively because, she says, it is in line with our readership. She agrees that the appeal goes beyond politics and finds the show is enjoyed fairly equally by men and women. In the age of streaming, it's appointment viewing. A series, everyone makes a point to watch when it airs, so they can talk about it the next day. She adds, the average American does not care if the show they watch is nominated for an Emmy or gets attention from some critics. They watch it because it's entertaining. Bowlby also suggests Yellowstone is a bit of a contrast to a lot of what you see on television now, with its wide open spaces and the celebration of nature. That is especially appealing when nearly every other show takes place in cramped offices and cluttered apartments. It is what makes country living successful, as well as other rural-themed lifestyle publications that appeal both to people who live on ranches and to people who live in cities and dream about ranches. See also Cowboys and Indians magazine, which has covered Yellowstone alongside Native American fashion and the best places to buy rustic-looking furniture, or Ree Drummond's The Pioneer Woman franchise, which sells a cheerful image of a hard-working family living off the land. If the Yellowstone audience has expanded, the ratings nearly doubling year after year since the first season, Bowlby thinks one reason is the pandemic, when people stuck at home all over the country binged the series. In a strange showbiz quirk, the streaming rights were sold to Peacock before it became a hit, and before the service, formerly known as CBS All Access, rebranded as Paramount Plus. All of its spin-offs, last year's 1883, this year's 1923, and the as-yet-unscheduled 6666, are on Paramount Plus. Bowlby's take is seconded by David Glasser, a Yellowstone producer, who admits that in the beginning the audience was everywhere but the coasts. These days, though, he runs into fans of all ages all over, including at his daughter's college, where he says he recently talked with a bunch of fraternity brothers in Yellowstone hats who wanted to talk about Cole Hauser's macho fan favorite ranch foreman Rip Wheeler. He thinks the show connects broadly because everyone has a family, even if they're not quite like the dysfunctional Duttons. That said, to devout Yellowstone fandom, there's an element of this show is for us and only us. As Bowlby says, the Western lifestyle is alive and well. There are people who live on ranches, work the land, and compete in rodeos. That is a big element of American culture that gets overlooked. I can vouch for this. I live in Arkansas, where kids often engage in typical adolescent pastimes like sports and band, while also raising livestock to show at regional fairs. Whenever I have a casual conversation about TV around here, I invariably hear, "Do you watch Yellowstone?" My staunch Southern Baptist father-in-law has sampled the show, and although he did not stick with it because of all the sex and swearing that people in his circles were pushing it on him in the first place, says something. For some, watching Yellowstone has practically become a social requirement. Tori F. admits that although most Yellowstone fans just want to hop online to talk about the Duttons, there are times and spaces, on Facebook especially, when the fandom gets a little Wild West. She recalls when she shared Paramount Network's support for the Black Lives Matter movement in 2020, it kicked off this whole three-week insanity of people fighting in the comments. She mentions death threats and doxing, lamenting it was the first time I had seen that type of thing for Yellowstone. The show itself is fairly even-handed. The dialogue and stories earnestly advance multiple points of view, be it conservative landowners protecting their legacies, indigenous activists reclaiming their land, environmentalists stopping exploitation, or career politicians doing what they do. Tori F. says if you dig into it, you can probably see where the fans' opinions default. But I think the show does a good job of not pitching to one side. She adds, a lot of my friends describe Yellowstone as a red state show made by blue state people. For Glasser, it is even simpler. He says Sheridan is mostly interested in giving audiences something to come back for. who watches and why are secondary to the Yellowstone boss's interest in doing what Tory F was looking for back in 2018. He wants to conjure up a good involving story to be enjoyed alongside other people. As Glasser puts it, when Taylor sits down to write at his computer, there is no notepad, no outline cards. There's no writer's rooms. It's just the Duttons and Taylor and his heart and soul. There is a photo here to share. It's a cowpoke. It's a man astride a horse wearing blue jeans, not the horse, the man. Blue jeans, a tan jacket over a black shirt, wearing a broad-brimmed black hat. The horse is standing still, almost asleep. It's brown with white socks, a white blaze on its forehead, saddled. In the background, there are a couple of white buildings, kind of blurry, but they're probably barns, with fences in front of them. And in the background, it looks like a granite shelf, a gray granite shelf. It is Costner's John Dutton, who is a mighty Montana rancher. That's why he has time to sit astride a napping horse. On the verso of that page, Time Off Television. It's a review, Divorce Manhattan Style, by Judy Berman. When a man abandons his family, that is not news, because it happens so often. But if a woman does it, that is news. It's also the man-bites-dog premise of Fleshman is in trouble. Taffy Brodesser Ackner's celebrated 2019 novel turned FX on Hulu miniseries, in which an Upper East Side physician flails his way through a divorce. One morning, Toby Fleshman, a perfectly cast Jesse Eisenberg, awakes in his sad new apartment to find that his ex, Rachel, Claire Danes, has left their two kids there in the middle of the night. Then she stops answering her phone for days that turn into weeks. Rachel's a monster, right? A top theater agent, she's always been too busy to spend much time with 11-year-old Hannah, Mira Mahoney Gross, and 9-year-old Solly, Maxim Swinton. Which must make Toby the hero. Well, not so fast. The whole point of Fleshman, a clever thought experiment of a book that doesn't quite work on screen, is that there's more than one side to the story. The show gives us Toby's version at excessive length first, unshackled from a wife who sees his calling as a glorified hobby and his $300,000 salary as a pittance. This erstwhile nebbish discovers he's now a hot dating app commodity. Yet even before Rachel disappears, separation is no panacea. Anxious and aggrieved by nature, he stresses over a potential promotion to which he feels entitled. Casual sex is fun, but he's still lonely enough to want to reconnect with old friends like Libby, Lizzie Kaplan, a former journalist and current disgruntled stay-at-home mom, whose voiceover narration frames the show. Fleshman is an exercise in inversion. Directors including Battle of the Sexes duo Valerie Faris and Jonathan Dayton riff on the bestseller's cover, an upside-down Manhattan skyline, in queasily tilted shots. It is not just Toby and Rachel whose marriage represents a reversal of traditional gender roles either. Once desperate for the approval of her colleagues at a men's magazine, Libby flips the script by telling a man's story and making space for perspectives like Rachel's. It is a smart conceit, Philip Roth meets Gone Girl, but it invites scrutiny the novel cannot support. Through Libby's eyes, Toby's Father of the Year journey is really a tale of men's entitlement and women who are punished for their ambition. Set in the summer of 2016, the show pounds home the point where Hillary signs with Hillary signs everywhere. Step back, however, and you might find it hard to care about any of these self-obsessed 1%ers, male or female. Forget rich white guys. Rich white ladies are the real victims. It's not exactly revolutionary thinking. Helmed by Brodesser Ackner, the FX series reproduces the book's blind spots. The bigger problem is the adaptation itself. The dialogue is sharp. And the actors great, especially Danes, whose talent for channeling big emotions gets a glorious showcase. Scenes of old friends bantering have a natural flow, but the pace is plodding, and the ever-present voiceover turns long stretches of the show into lectures, with the actors reduced to visual aids. When Fleischman works as a novel, it is thanks to Brodesser Ackner's skill at using the conventions of literature to explore perspectives that male writers rarely bother to imagine. When it falls apart on screen, it is because the medium no longer mirrors the message. This issue of Time features many, many pages. Let me see here how many there are. 27 pages of the best inventions, according to Time. I'm just going to skim through a few of these. That says, out of thin air, ether or ether diamonds, A-E-T-H-E-R. Companies selling lab-grown diamonds often appeal to consumers' sense of ethics and sustainability by citing the human rights and environmental implications of traditional diamond mining. Ether, or ether diamonds, is taking things a step further. Its diamonds are made from carbon sucked from the atmosphere, less expensive than mined diamonds, but more costly than other lab-grown varieties. They are created with carbon dioxide air capture technology. Ultimately, every atom of carbon that lands in that diamond was previously warming the planet, says CEO Ryan Sherman. After 8 to 12 weeks of chemical transformation, as well as cutting and polishing, they are ready to become part of a sparkly engagement ring. Ether, or ether, also uses a capital from its sales to help scale up the nascent carbon capture industry. That was by Eliza Brook. And next to it, Accessibility, a Bionic Future, Esper Hand, that's E-S-P-E-R, Hand, by Leslie Dickstein. Capitalizing on advances in artificial intelligence and digital signal processing, Esper Bionics Prosthetic Hand is the first AI-powered, cloud-based robotic prosthetic that gets smarter over time. The lightweight device has up to 24 wearable sensors that detect and process muscle activity and brain impulses. Machine learning from Esper's platform enables the hand to act more intuitively over time. Esper Bionics CEO and co-founder Dima Gazda, a medical doctor and engineer, sees the prosthetic market as ripe for disruption and setting the stage for a bionic future. The most important technology developed in the next 30 years will be electronics inside the human body, he says. Adapting to Extreme Heat by Jennifer Duggan. Many parts of the world this year experienced record temperatures as climate change became more apparent. Over the coming years, individuals, cities, and countries will be forced to adapt, and inventors are finding ways to help. Chemicals and energy for traditional AC units exacerbate climate change, but the Gradient Window air conditioner is powered by an emission and energy-reducing heat pump. Invert, I-N-V-E-R-T, self-shading windows reduce solar heat gain by blocking light when the sun is at its highest. Street Bonds reflective coating is paint for asphalt that keeps pavement cooler. And BMW has created the first color-changing vehicle, the iX Flow, that can turn darker or lighter to attract or reflect heat. Agriculture is particularly at the mercy of higher temperatures. The climate AI forecasting tool predicts conditions years in advance, allowing agribusinesses to plan effectively. Heat-proofing utilities infrastructure can help prevent power outages. Urban Footprint Grid Resilience Insights uses data to allow governments and companies to make better decisions about where to prioritize upgrades. And GridAware is a network of sensors along power lines that alert the utility when they detect a problem. With extreme temperatures come droughts, and Epic CleanTech's One Water system treats and recycles wastewater for reuse in large-scale residential and commercial developments to reduce water use. The Reva, REVA, showerhead BioEssence saves about 50% of the water used in a normal shower by reducing flow when you step out of the stream to lather, while Kara Pure, K-A-R-A space, P-U-R-E, uses the air's humidity to create potable water. One Tiny Incision by Vicarious Surgical Robotic System by Matt Alderton. Vicarious Surgical's mission is to make surgery safer. The company created a robotic system featuring a camera with 360-degree views. Surgeons wear a VR headset while controlling the robot's two arms, each with 28 sensors for extreme precision. The starting point, a 1.5 centimeter, 0.6 inch incision through which the robot enters the patient's body. Complication rates from open surgeries are 15% to 20% just from the incision, says Vicarious Surgical CEO Adam Sachs. By making incisions really small, you can knock complication rates down to about 1%. The company, which went public last year, is currently building its Beta 2 prototype with plans to introduce a $1.2 million system to hospitals as early as 2024. I'm still checking the headlines here. A mini microscope. Kuang Ying ENT iMicro C Smartphone Microscope by Joe Mullick. This fingertip-sized microscope, which weighs a half gram, 0.02 ounces, and easily attaches to any smartphone camera lens with a nano suction pad, magnifies small objects up to 200 times. According to Shanghai-based Kuang Ying ENT, the microscope is ideal for large micro-objects like insects or gears inside watches. Photography enthusiasts and kids getting into science can enjoy a closer look at the world for a small fraction of the cost of a traditional microscope. An optional U-ruler, micro-ruler, measures micro-objects and calibrates the scale bar in a companion app. Magnetic Music by Jennifer Duggan. Earshot's wireless headphones. Earshot's founder, James Bell Booth, could not find headphones that stayed on while he was trail running or biking. So he came up with a solution: headphones with a magnetic earlock system that keeps wireless earbuds in place no matter how strenuous the activity. Earshots allow in some ambient sound so that users can remain aware of their surroundings, and each earbud rotates up to 40 degrees to accommodate different ear shapes. What began as a Kickstarter campaign is now for sale globally. And I will share a couple more of these. Optimizing Serums. Droplet Microinfuser by Guadalupe Gonzalez. Droplet co-founders Madhavi Gavini and Rati Srinivas knew most of the topical serums people use on their face simply evaporate, and they set out to create a painless way to get more product under the skin. Their patented technology transforms water-based serums such as collagen, glycolic acid, and retinol into aerosols, then into tiny micro droplets that their research shows penetrate the skin's barrier 20 times as deep as topical creams. Gavini and Srinivas are now pursuing FDA approval to use the device to administer topical drugs for medical conditions like epidermolysis bullosa, a rare disease that causes blistering skin. Climate-friendly farming, perennial soil-based carbon removal verification platform by Ki May Husner. 100 billion tons, that is how much CO2 soil could remove from the atmosphere by 2100 with less tilling and other farming techniques. But that means transforming agricultural practices globally. We're establishing an entire ecosystem for farmers to get paid for not only producing food in a way that sustains the soil, but also pulling carbon out of the air, says Oleksiy Zuk, co-founder and president of Perennial. The platform analyzes the chemical composition of soil currently in the U.S. and Australia and provides standardized and cheaper data to help corporations achieve net zero targets while putting more offset dollars into farmers' pockets. Under the heading Toys and Play, again written by Jennifer Duggan, a bear that hugs back, Hugimals. As weighted blankets gained popularity in recent years, Hugimals founder Marina Kittikel saw an opportunity for a more portable product to provide comfort anytime you need a calming hug. Developed in consultation with therapists, psychologists, and pediatricians, Hugimals are weighted stuffed animals that feature a glass bead filling to give the sensation of being hugged. The company partnered with the Toy Foundation to make Hugimals available to patients in 5 children's hospitals. One 9-year-old tester reported feeling safer snuggling with one. Hugimals has also seen orders from educators who use them in schools to help kids manage big emotions and stay focused. A mini nuclear reactor. NuScale Power Module by Jillian Mock. Shrinking reactors makes nuclear power safer, more scalable, and less costly. That is the idea behind the NuScale Power Module, the first and only small modular reactor, SMR, to receive design approval from the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission. Instead of the traditional concrete-domed plant, each NuScale module consists of a 76-foot-tall, 15-foot-diameter, cylindrical reactor and containment vessel sitting in a steel-lined, water-filled pool below ground. The SMRs automatically shut down and self-cool in the event of power failure, and each generates about 77 megawatts of electricity, enough to power 60,000 homes. The company's first power plant could be running by 2029 in Idaho. Sewage surveillance, BioBot Analytics wastewater monitoring platform. This COVID-19 pandemic mainstreamed wastewater-based epidemiology, which analyzes sewage to detect disease outbreaks. BioBot Analytics can identify current community levels of disease and opioid use from just 150 milliliters of an aggregate sewage sample from a 24-hour period. Because samples include everyone in a sewage system, there's an incredible amount of intelligence in wastewater, says Nusha Gailey, BioBot's president and co-founder. The company is the first to commercialize data from sewage. The CDC in September expanded BioBot's contract to include monkeypox monitoring. Continuous stroke monitoring. Now, I'm not citing the authors of these two columns because they're in initials. One is JG and one is GG. Oh, JG may be Jeremy Gantz, and GG may be Guadalupe Gonzalez. Anyway, continuous stroke monitoring, NeurAlert. Every 40 seconds, someone in the U.S. has a stroke. Early treatment is key to minimize adverse outcomes. Yet a recent study of in-hospital strokes found that most go undetected for over 4 hours. Enter NeurAlert, which the FDA designated a breakthrough device last year. The pair of smart wristbands uses a proprietary algorithm to track arm asymmetry or weakness, common symptoms of stroke. NeurAlert can detect symptoms in as little as 15 minutes and automatically alert medical staff to spring into action. The company is targeting commercial release in 2023. A wearable for women, Bellabeat Ivy by Julia Zorthian. As fitness trackers gained popularity, Bellabeat's founders noticed many did not cater to women's bodies. Bellabeat Ivy, IVY, the first health tracker engineered specifically for women, looks more like a bracelet than tech. The diamond-shaped device, which has no display, tracks menstrual cycles, fertility, and menopause symptoms, as well as heart rate, hydration, sleep, and other activities. And the companion app's algorithms take into account life stage factors such as pregnancy and menopause when processing health data. That helps a Bellabeat coach make personalized recommendations to help users target goals such as losing weight or becoming stronger. Medical Breakthroughs by Angela Haupt. Over the past 3 years, medical attention has been focused on developing tools to combat COVID-19, and more recently, monkeypox. For immunocompromised individuals, Evusheld COVID-19 antibody therapy has provided some protection for those who are not able to be vaccinated, while antiviral drug Paxlovid minimizes symptoms. We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.